Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG pod overflow, the Cinephobe cold opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
Said the OG pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing it, and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays, you're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're gonna get Amin in those, so you gotta listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like, because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora, he's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/countthedings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
Hey, listener, Zach Harper here. Underdog Fantasy, the easiest place to play fantasy sports. Also, fastest growing fantasy app in the industry. Here's how it works. The Pick'em game. Pick whether your favorite players will have a higher or lower stat total in this week's game for a chance to win big. How big, you ask? I'm so glad you asked that question, listener. You can win up to 100 times your money in a single night. Pick between 2 and 5 players, build a pick'em entry. You can also do rivals picks. You can put like Tyrese Haliburton and Jalen Brunson against each other, and whoever has more points, more assists, more rebounds, whatever you want to do, that is your rivals pick. I would maybe go with Jalen Brunson in these playoffs. By the way, in the regular season, Jalen Brunson, scoring tear, going higher on his point totals all the time. Joel Embiid, whenever he did actually play, higher on his scoring totals all the time. Victor Wembanyama, for the next 15, 20 years, here's a pro tip for you, take higher on the blocks. That's right. So you're probably wondering, how do you sign up? Oh my God, listener, you are full of good questions today. Sign up with the promo code DING, that's D-I-N-G, to claim your special pick first-time deposit offer, up to $250 in bonus cash. $250, man, that's a lot. Visit underdogfantasy.com or find them in the App Store. And don't forget to register with our code DING, D-I-N-G, to claim your special pick and first-time deposit offer, up to $250 in bonus cash. Must be 18 or older, 21 or older in Massachusetts, Arizona, 19 or older in Alabama and Nebraska, and present in a state where Underdog Fantasy operates. Terms apply. Concerned with your play, call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit www.ncpgambling.org. Arizona 1-800-NEXT-STEP. That's 1-800-639-8783. Or text NEXT STEP to 53342. New York, call the 24/7 HOPE line at 1-877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the latest edition of the Woke Bros. Of course, I'm your co-host, Big Waz, aka Wazzy Lambray. We took a break last week to get our house in order. Unfortunately, Nando's still on break. but we got, man, our resident Woke Bro, man. This guy is part of what we do around here, man. Daniel Bessner, what's poppin', brother?
What's up, Waz? Thanks for having me. Thanks for having me. I appreciate
it. Listen, we couldn't have you at a more exciting time, to be honest. You mentioned that you had to go grab a suit. Tell the people why you needed a new suit, DB.
So I'm going to be on Bill Maher on Friday.
Wow.
This will be released, I think, Thursday. So tomorrow, check it out. And I didn't have a suit, so I had to go buy a suit.
Well, this will be released on Friday, but
day of.
Yeah, check, so tonight, watch. Check that out. Yeah, you know what's so crazy, man? Back in the days, that used to be my entire political diet was Bill Maher. This would have been like Barry
I've been watching
years.
It since Politically Incorrect. I mean, wow. I don't know if you remember in the 90s, like it was one of the first political shows I've ever been on, and I'm on with Glenn Lowry. So,
oh my goodness.
Yeah, my buddy Glenn Lowry. So it'll be a fun one.
Glenn Lowry, black conservative iconoclast.
Yes, definitely iconoclast.
Definitely, you know, he is he still an economist? Do you ever lose your stripes as an economist? Like, could you ever not be a historian, DB?
So he's really, you know, he was like had a liberal turn in the 90s and 2000s. And it's really like post BLM that he has gone conservative. But yeah, no, he's an economist. He's like I believe, developed the term social capital.
Wow.
Like, yeah. So I, at some point, and I don't think I'm wrong, he was like maybe going to be a Nobel Prize winner.
Wow. Know, like, so he's okay. So he's like hardcore.
No, he's like a math economist. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And then he did like popular writing and stuff. No, but he's like a real deal economist.
Yeah. That's ill, man. I'm very happy for you. That is probably the biggest boomer political show.
I'm gonna convert them all, man. They're all gonna be socialists by the end of the episode. I'm setting that as my goal.
How does that happen? Does somebody like? Do you just put out shit in the nation and
literally that's it?
Show bookers are just like, yeah, we need to have this fool on.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's literally just if someone catches your article, I think it's really that random. And then I think you probably have to have a bit. If it was my first article or second mm-hmm. article that they were interested in,
I mean,
I don't
but you have a book, you're a freaking
professor. I'm like, tenured. Yeah, yeah.
I'm tenured.
Yeah. So I could say what I want.
this is incredible, man. I'm really happy for you. The baby is almost here. This is just a big time for you, but we got you up here, Danny, because your latest article in the New Republic is called A Bad Breakup, The Discontents of Francis Fukuyama, where, you know, I feel like this dude's essay, The End of History, is not something that I was very conscious of, but within my own sort of political diet, if you will, within the last, I want to say like 18 months, it's really been coming up. I think what a lot of people were responding to is the sort of failures of the liberal regime during the COVID epidemic, where it's just like anything could fucking just break this house of cards, right? And just this idea of liberalism's inevitability and it's, you know, it's clearly the best way we could be doing anything. I think a lot of people sort of looking back at that concept and critiquing it. And just before we even get into that essay, The End of History, could you explain who this dude is?
Yeah, for sure. So he started his career at a think tank, the Rand Corporation, which we've spoken about.
How do you start your whole life at a think tank? That's crazy.
That's he was actually a PhD. Was a PhD, I believe, in Harvard in political science.
Okay, so that's how you get into a think tank.
And so, and so that was a real viable career path, particularly in the 70s. So he starts in the late 70s. He basically just writes about Soviet Union, particularly in the Middle East and what's now called Southwest Asia, Afghanistan, Pakistan, kind of moves towards writing about Soviet policy and what was then called the Third World, what's now called the Global South, and then wrote this
So people are clear, it's not just that he's writing about Soviet policy. It's like in contrast to the West. Right. Like, I feel like, Danny, like whenever you attack a subject, it's like, all right, whatever its historical context is, we're kind of talking about that. But it's not like in context with cancel culture. You understand what I'm saying? Like, there's nothing that you're sort of weighing it against, whereas his studies are weighed against what we're doing here in the West.
Right. And I think that's a really important point, because what people are arguing when Fukuyama basically comes of intellectual age, people like Henry Kissinger is the most famous. He was essentially saying that the Soviet Union was not, as earlier generations have said, like this ideological enemy, that it wasn't bent necessarily on dominating the world through communism, but that it's kind of a normal great power. It wanted resources, it wanted security, et cetera, and that's why you could do something like détente with the Soviet Union. This is why Kissinger is behind détente, which basically means lessening of tensions, because the Soviet Union is a normal power. What Fukuyama says, and this is in line with what Reagan said, is that actually the people in the 50s and the early 60s were correct. The Soviet Union is an ideological power. It does have a world-spanning goal, and that is to spread communism. So the emphasis on ideology is important, because Fukuyama becomes this big defender of liberalism. And so he was, as you were basically saying, he counterposes liberalism with Soviet communism or Bolshevism. And this is what he does in the 80s until he writes this piece, The End of History, and we could get into it.
Yeah, just so before we go on, I feel like in order, like everybody who's listening to this knows that you and I are sort of both materialists, right? And so just outright, we reject the notion that the Soviet Union is acting in like some idealistic fashion, like they're adhering to some strict communist or definitely not socialist tendencies. I feel like there's no actual evidence that would suggest that this were true, that these people were so ideological in their thinking and in their actions. I disagree with this homie.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, you know, when you look at their archives, they discuss communism and they discuss ideology, but the question is, what is really driving events, right? If like people say a lot of shit, I say a lot of shit,
yes,
but you know, exactly. What's actually driving my life choices, right? And I think if you look at what the Soviet Union was doing, a lot of it, not all of it, but a lot of it is just typical great power stuff. And I just to bring it to today, I think you could say the same about China, right? I don't think China's really 100% bent on ideology. Yeah,
I don't even see how you can make the counter argument that China is invested in awakening the working classes of the world.
Right. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous to even say.
It out loud, yeah. It just doesn't make any sense. Like when the Soviets invade Afghanistan, are they like trying to bring global communism to Afghanistan?
It's absolutely ridiculous. this is what people were saying. Because America was so powerful after World War II that it had the freedom to act ideologically, because it could do things like invade Vietnam and invade Iraq. And to be frank, not that many consequences blew back on people at home, particularly after the all-volunteer force happened and you got rid of the draft in the early 70s. So what they were doing, I think, was projecting onto another power.
Got you. And so, yeah, I just wanted to get that out the way so people understand like what this guy's sort of MO is. And so that's the context within which he's writing this paper. It's like the, you know, and again, this is what think tanks exist to do. I think that's important to explain to the audience. Like, these guys exist to come up with ideas about how the world works that people that actually push the button on these decisions will actually read these papers, will actually be briefed on these ideas.
Yeah, and especially Fukuyama. I think this happens still today, but it happened a lot in the 80s. He actually in the 80s moved back and forth between the think tank and the State Department.
Wow.
So when he wrote The End of History, he was actually at the State Department, but he had been at RAND, he had been at the various parts of the government. He goes back and forth. So this is this sort of revolving door thing. And as far as I know, I'm not 100%, but I'm pretty sure he never went to the government after The End of History, because once you become famous, Waz, you and I know.
What's the fuck?
You want to go to the club. You know, you want to go to Musso and Frank's. You know,
absolutely no reason to schlepping to D.C. Yeah, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. So he became like this celebrity. But we could get into The End of History whatever way you want to take it.
No. That's what I want to get into. Can you just explain to the people the argument that was being made within this paper? And why do you think this argument resonated with so many people in the chattering classes and just became so influential?
It's a good point. So the article is called "The End of History?" Question mark. So the first thing is that by history, Fukuyama didn't mean that things that happen in the world.
Right.
He was using it in kind of a
technical term. Sort of title. Honestly,
it's yeah, it's a great title. You know, yeah. A mentor once said, if you're going to make an argument, anything worth stating is worth overstating. And so it's one of those sorts of claims. So just a very brief 2-second.
Yeah, please.
2-second thing. So there was a philosopher in the early 19th century called Hegel, George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. And he argued about capital H history and how history moved. And Hegel argued that it was a series of ideas, the capital I idea, that came together. And Marx actually was, as I'm sure you know, he basically famously, quote, turned Hegel on its head by saying it wasn't ideas that mattered, but it was material relations, but it still functioned in a similar process. So that's the way that Fukuyama is using history, is sort of this grand human movement. And what he essentially said was that the 1980s demonstrated that even the communists were accepting liberal principles. The communists were accepting that free markets were good. The communists were accepting that you needed to give some political freedoms. Famously, this is glasnost and perestroika in the Soviet Union. So even before the Soviet Union collapsed, what Fukuyama was saying was that basically everyone accepted that liberalism and liberal ideas had won. Right, they won the great battle for ideology, and that's what.
Can I ask you a question that nobody ever seems to explain to me? Why is liberalism so connected to this concept of free market and free trade principles? Why are they so tied at the hip? And why do people who are, you know, they just believe in naked, unvarnished capitalism? Why are they the only ones who get to sort of cleave themselves to this concept of civil liberties and social freedoms?
It's a great question. So the way that I like to think about it is that in the 19th century, you know, we're Marxists, the Industrial Revolution happened. That was a big deal. It totally reshaped human capabilities, right? You were able to produce more calories. You were able to produce more goods, et cetera. You're able to travel.
Some people might argue that's why we had the Civil War. It's just
definitely.
Yo, bro, we got to start doing things a completely different way than we do them right now. Sorry, slaveholders. Right.
And so one of the arguments, the classic arguments that were made is that like the slave South was an atavistic, right? It was from the past. And so if you look at the first 70 years of U.S. history and the first few presidents, for example, Washington, Jefferson, not Adams, who's from the North, but a lot of them are from like the planter class. And so over the course of the first half of the 19th century, the quote unquote North becomes more powerful because it's industrialized. So that's just a microcosm of what's happening all across the world. So in the 19th century, you got in response to those material changes, a series of ideologies rose up, one of which was liberalism. Another one was communism. You might consider like the reactionary right that morphed into fascism to be another one. And these were basically all responses to how you deal with this huge transformation in human life and society. And so what liberals argued is that the best way to encourage human flourishing is through this freedom, right? And freedom has various sort of valences. There's something called positive freedom, and that's freedom to do something, and that's something called negative freedom, freedom from something, for example, the government. And in the American context, it's really that negative form of freedom that has predominated since World War II.
100%.
I think because the nation is so rich, that the nation was so traditionally rich that it was able to basically emphasize freedom from. Things are changing now because we're becoming more like other countries and inequality has increased so much. So that's what Fukuyama, just to bring it back, means by liberalism and means by history.
Got you. And because, okay, and so I understand that these ideas of liberalism emerge out of an already sort of capitalistic society. Capitalism just is, and so therefore this is how we are just going to manage it. Whereas these crazy sicko communists are like, no, why don't we do capitalism another way?
So I think this is a crucial point, because Marx actually said you needed capitalism. Mm-hmm. So basically, everyone on all sides says you need capitalism, because it was capitalism that basically did the huge shoot up on the graph, where you're now producing much. You're able to produce more calories. You're able to produce more goods. You're able to travel, blah, blah, blah. The question was, how do you deal with capitalism? Mm-hmm. And Marx and the socialists and the communists were like, you could actually control it through human action. You could centrally plan. You could predict things. And the liberals were like, no.
Hello, listener. Guess who's back? It's me, Anthony Mays, your favorite butcher-turned-podcast producer, and I'm here to talk to you about ButcherBox. ButcherBox is the most convenient way to get high-quality meat and seafood that you can trust delivered straight to your doorstep, free shipping, vacuum-sealed packaging. It's ready to go right then. It's ready to pop in the freezer. You get exclusive member deals and a variety of high quality cuts at an amazing value. Going to the grocery store can be a huge pain. You're usually in a rush at an inconvenient time. You're waiting in line at the meat counter. You're taking a number. Maybe this place doesn't have a number. You're jostling with fellow customers. You're trying to get that ribeye that you want or that nice piece of salmon. Maybe the butcher that you're dealing with has a bad attitude or something. I don't know. That was never me, I promise. But maybe it happens. ButcherBox takes all of that out of the picture. You are always prepared with meat and seafood in the freezer, and you're not going to find quality for this price anywhere else other than ButcherBox. So sign up at butcherbox.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S, and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional $20 off. You can choose salmon, chicken breasts, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/dings and use code DINGS, D-I-N-G-S, to choose your free for a year offer plus get $20 off your first order. Hello, listener. I'm sure you don't need me to tell you that we at Cinephobe love our pets. Zach and Boogie are inseparable. I've got two cats and a dog, and Amin is giving his best ass on performance to convince dog owners that he loves their pet.
Hey, little, hey, boy, how you doing? And Noodle's just like,
ah, whatever. Which is why today's episode is sponsored by the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program. For many pet parents, summer is all about making travel plans like adventuring through the national parks, visiting pet-friendly beaches, or road tripping across the country. Wherever your journeys take you and your furry friend, you can help protect them along the way with the plan from ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are, because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
The disembodied hand of the market is going to manage things. Now, these are all very like ideal forms. There's a lot of variations, but sure, at their base, this is what the different ideologies are saying.
Okay. And so Fukuyama, of course, he's coming out of the liberal ideology because, and you know what this reminds me of, DB? It reminds me of me when I used to root for Michael Jordan and the Bulls in the 90s. It's like this idea that like, well, Michael Jordan's the best. The Bulls keep winning championships. Obviously, this is the only way that this could ever get done. Never mind when some other psychopath maniac comes along and wants to punch his teammates in the face and do other things. It's like, ah, I don't know. Maybe that like kind of worked for Jordan, but that doesn't seem like, it seems like when you're making this argument, it's just like, we've won. And so this is the right way. And anybody who doesn't understand that kind of will not recognize the victory.
So this is really interesting because there's a lot of the end of history essay that is like that, where it's like, yo, we won. We fucking won. But it's, what's really also interesting is that there's sort of a melancholy in the essay because Fukuyama, like actually like a lot of others, he wasn't alone in this, thought like communism was more vital. It was more romantic. It was a greater cause. Like liberalism is like what you're going to technocratically determine who gets what. There's a bloodlessness to it.
Yeah. Hell
so
yeah.
It was interesting because what I think Fukuyama was unconsciously doing was he was lamenting the end of the Cold War because it was only in the battle with an ideological enemy that liberalism was not bloodless, right? That liberalism was able to really call for.
Yeah, you had something to sort of galvanize or organize around was this defeat of this other thing. If that other thing doesn't exist, then what do you do? Retreat into, you know, collecting PhDs and trinkets,
like or what you know what you do. You're like the finance bros in the city, right? You pretend you're conquering Rome when you're moving fucking numbers around,
right?
You need to feel that vitality and that romanticism. And Fukuyama was like, oh shit, that's gonna go away now. And I don't think he was wrong. You know, I think there we do all feel alienated. There is sort of a legitimation crisis in American society, and that's because liberalism doesn't provide meaning. It doesn't provide one with a grand project. There's a lot of other reasons for that. There's a lot of other reasons for the ennui. It also makes things really unequal. But, you know, like, who's going to die for liberalism? I sure as hell am not.
Jonathan Chait sure might.
Maybe my friend Jonathan Chait.
But, you know, and again, in reading your sort of essay, which, by the way, you're talking about a newer paper in your autograph where he's kind of like, it's the Chait thing. It's like classical liberals are sort of, they feel very defensive of their project, right? In the face of the obvious problems of the world and in the face of no real competition anywhere to speak of, and, you know, liberal hegemony everywhere, there are all these problems. And like Jonathan Chait, Fukuyama decided that, no, we need to defend the project. This was clearly the best that could have ever been done.
Right. And I think an important thing, which I'm sure you've come across in your own life, is that there's sort of, people say it's mature, right? Like it's mature to embrace the
centrism.
Limits.
Centrism is the mature thing. When you have ideals, when you have hopes and dreams, you're a loser, dreamer, unpragmatic.
Right.
When you want to just, you know, just stay stagnant forever or even retreat backwards, you know, centrists will also be like, there's something fundamentally wrong with you. Like you're an unserious person if you're sort of reactionary, conservative as well. But absolutely, like any centrist that you talk to, like I remember people just being like, well, Bernie's ideas are fucking stupid because guess what? They love Joe Biden, you fucking idiot. Don't you see that people love Joe Biden? All right.
Well, it's a very limited imagination. It's kind of funny because one of Marx's biggest warnings was that we can't let capitalism control us. We've got to control capitalism. And when people make arguments like that, they're basically saying human beings have no agency. Mm. That capitalism is, you just got to do what capitalism does. It's kind of the metaphor I use is artificial intelligence. It's people today treat it like Skynet has become self-aware. There's no way to control this thing. It's just going to do. And that's a very, I think, depressing and fundamentally incorrect understanding of how the world works.
And I'll say this about centrists and liberals as a whole. I feel like all of them, by and large, live very comfortable lives. And so like a disruption to that seems insane and unserious. I understand that. Like materially, why would you want your great life to be disrupted by some people that might want to hit the streets, might want to fucking riot over right. some healthcare. Might want to burn the trash in Paris and not let things, you know, and bring some disorder to everyday life. If you're some fucking professional who has a nice life and you know, the things that you worry about is shit like, I don't fucking know, whether you're saying the right pronouns to people or not, not to say that you shouldn't try to do that, but if that's your biggest worry in life, I understand why you don't want things disturbed. That's like,
the way that I view it is, do liberal programs involve liberal elites giving up their money?
No.
And the answer is always no. And so, again, this is the importance of having a material view of things. Because right. if they're not giving up their money, then someone's pulling the wool over your eyes. Not 100%, but just as a rule of thumb, if they're not giving up their money, they're not really interested in change. And I think that's right.
And so, okay, just to get into the main potatoes of what this guy's saying in his argument, and this is what I want to get into with you, because I think it's kind of interesting, and you've talked about this on your show, you've talked about it on ours, and the reason why he's like the end of history is just like, not only is liberalism dominant, like the idea that what they're doing in China and Russia, for instance, even though I reject that these are sort of counter ideologies. I completely reject that as just it's because it's not like when China comes into, say, Africa or wherever they invest in,
they're not spreading like Chinese communism.
No, they're not. And it's not even just Chinese communism, GB. They don't go in and say, y'all need to do y'all government like us.
Right.
Put spyware in.
U.S. delusion.
Yeah. They don't. They just straight up like, yo, we're going to get what we need to get out of this. However y'all want to manage y'all shit, go ahead. But they don't go in and do that. So like, just the idea that China or Russia offers some huge counterbalance. You know, I was listening to Pascal, our boy Pascal Robert, talk about the huge investment that China's making in Africa. And he's just like, yo, it's kind of nice that, you know, these African nations have an alternative as far as business partners are concerned to the US and the West. But like, it's fucking China, you know?
Absolutely. And it's kind of funny because in my mind, it's an American delusion to think that you're able to spread your ideology across the world. It's kind of a wild belief. If you like if you try to take off your American glasses and put on your sort of dead alien glasses, if you look at this, it's kind of wild that any nation could think they could do it successfully. But what Americans have done is they projected that onto the Soviet Union first and later onto China, today onto China.
Well, Danny, don't you know that the Soviet Union came down because the people wanted to wear blue jeans? They wanted Levi's. Don't you know
rock and roll and Levi's.
So, no, but what I do want to say about that is, if the argument is like, and you even mentioned this in your piece, it's like if you have a group of immigrants, or let's just say some refugees from Yemen, like let's just say you really explained to them, like you really gave them a clear picture of what they could possibly do in America and what they could do in China, they'd fucking pick America. Without question.
Yeah. No, of course. Of course. And I think...
And that's a persuasive argument,
yeah,
to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, also, one can't forget, like, most nations in the world that the United States have been involved with have had a pretty negative experience. Right. And what's kind of the tragedy of one of the many tragedies of American history is like after colonization, after colonialism, a lot of leaders in the third world really thought the U.S. believed in its rhetoric and that they were going to help them. And this is again and again and again, we're betrayed. So, you know,
I mean, if the state was born in a revolution, I think certain people have differing views about how legitimately you can view that revolution for various reasons. I think some people are just like, well, I mean, they overthrew the fucking crown, but they were just crowns people themselves. Look at what they did to the Native Americans. Look at how they dominated the rest of the land and all the raping, pillaging, and killing that came behind it. Some people would say that this wasn't some, like, you know, they didn't overthrow some power. They were the power and just sort of replaced the management structure. I don't know. I don't think I have a fully formed view of that. But yes, a lot of younger nations looked at America and was like, look at those people. They were a colony of the British Empire and they overthrew those folks.
Exactly. And so what Fukuyama, just to bring it back, what he was saying is that all of these nations would now become liberal. And in some mm-hmm. sense, he wasn't wrong. And we mm-hmm. can turn to talk to that now if you'd
yes,
like.
Please.
Because basically, he said that everyone would become liberal. And he was wrong about that. Like, clearly, Russia's not liberal. Clearly, China's not liberal. But what he was really saying was that everyone's going to become capitalist. Or at least that's embedded in the argument. So Fukuyama, kind of two cheers for Fukuyama, at least in terms of him being correct, is that everyone is capitalist. Now, I just don't buy the argument that China is not capitalist.
How could you make that argument?
People on the left do, but I just don't think like what they do is they point to elements of the Chinese system that have communistic features. And I would agree.
What elements are those, DB, just for the people at home?
There is a form of state planning. You know, they okay. do kind of cut off the heads of the billionaires every now and again. It is governed sure. by a communist party. But I think that...
But to be clear, there are really poor people, even still in China, even as rich as they become, and there are ungodliness.
Oh, yeah, yeah, and billionaires.
In the country.
Precisely. And since the 80s, Deng Xiaoping really did liberalize the economy. He opened it up to market features. And I would say on the international stage, China represents something called state capitalism, which is a state-directed capitalism. You know, China will pick particular industries. The government will be heavily involved in particular industries. It's not a form of capitalism that's like the neoliberal capitalism in the United States. But I think it's fundamentally able to be identified as capitalism. And I think this is true of Russia. It's an oligarchic capitalism, a kleptocratic capitalism, but still a capitalism. It's true of Hungary. Maybe it's not true of North Korea, but it's true of basically every other country in the world. And so, and to some degree, that prediction about the universalization of some form of Western hegemonic ideology was proven correct. And the interesting thing to me, and this is how I kind of end the piece, is that liberalism, as you talked about at the beginning, so obviously fucked up in so many, did not achieve its great promises. But there hasn't been an ideological response to liberalism. You know, there's been some socialist-ist policies in the United States. There's sort of the MAGA racism in the United States as well.
Yeah.
But these are meaningfully, and also like both of those, I would argue, contain significant features of liberalism, which was always racist on some parts and always had socialist parts of it, right?
Also, they're like just the idea, like some of this shit, I view it, some of the stuff that we call conservative, I view as liberal. The gun shit. Just the idea that you would let a bunch of motherfuckers, a bunch of citizens go ahead, just have guns. That feels liberal to me.
Well, it's certainly individualistic. And stuff like that is connected to the indigenous genocide.
Like China's government would not allow for that.
Australia's government doesn't allow for it. That's a peculiar... peculiar American pathology.
They're not just going to let a bunch of citizens, individual citizens, have the right to blow people's brains off on a whim. Like, it doesn't make any sense.
With automatic rifles, with military rifles.
Like, that's not a thing. Like, we call that conservative, but like, realistically, a conservative government would have bopped these fools in the head already, took their guns, and if they tried to play around, killed them. Like, this wouldn't
it's
even
wild.
Be a...
It's wild that
this wouldn't even be a discussion. And so, yeah, I guess, you know, like you said, this guy was right about something different, right? But to me, which I guess is at the core of it, it's like, yeah, everybody's freaking capitalist. And I think the only thing I will say begrudgingly about... you know, just from what I know about what we have here in America, nobody seems to want to do anything about how fucked up it is.
No,
and so maybe it's just not fucked up enough.
I think the two things, this is like real 40,000 feet thinking. Cheap food and cheap entertainment goes a long way. If you look at a lot of revolutions in particular, they people usually follow food scarcity. Mm-hmm. And so I think if you're able, I think the American life has proven that if you're able to provide people with calories and entertainment, defined however you want, the you know, the infamous opiate of the masses, no longer religion, but something else, I think that goes a long way. And I think that's a depressing thing, because even people who are very poor, not 100% by any stretch, but you could always eat shitty fast food and get pack yourself filled with calories. There are places in this country, of course, the disclaimer, that are experiencing true food scarcity and things like that. But overall, you're not going to get like 1918, 1990, 19 post-war Germany people starving. Right. You know, it's a different scale.
Or even look, man, like people talked about the Great Recession, that it was the worst fucking financial collapse since the Great Depression. Like, there wasn't really like widespread food lines and like, you know, soup kitchens didn't fill up to the brim, to be honest. Obviously, people suffered. People, you know, lost a massive amount of wealth as far as, you know, wealth that was in their houses and stuff like that. That's not the same to... as desolate, like as being completely desolate, right?
No, I mean, the Great Depression, absolutely. The Great Depression, unemployment reached upwards of like 25%. You know, it never approached that. But I think the thing is like the primary impulses, food, sex, shelter, something to do with your time, are largely satisfied through the internet and things like that, through TV, through movies, whatever it is. And I think those things really do go a long way toward preventing a revolution.
So what's a, so what's a sad sack socialist communist in America to do or think or to even wonder or dream for a better existence for people in this country, if not this whole goddamn planet?
Well, you step
know,
one.
I know this is a heavy question, but like.
No, I have an answer. Step one is subscribe to Woke Bros, and step two is subscribe to American Prestige.
That's it.
And that's the way to go. I mean, I think whatever the solution is, I don't have a pat one, but I think you have to look at your situation realistically as much as possible. That to me is what Marx and others meant by historical materialism. So I don't think anything's going to be gained by fantasies about the strength of the left or the rising of the working classes. I think you have to be extraordinarily pessimistic and cynical. And from there, you start identifying the social fissures, the social movements, whatever, what have you, that can begin to make real change. But don't be naive. Don't have the wool pulling over your eyes, and then go from there. Maybe in 10 years, we could talk about a more positive program.
That is beautiful, man. That is Daniel Bessner. You can read his latest article in The Nation, A Bad Breakup, The Discontents of Francis Fukuyama. Of course, make sure you subscribe to his Substack, American Prestige, one of my favorite podcasts on the planet. And if your broke ass got an HBO account, HBO Max, check him out on Real Time with Bill Maher tonight. What's that? April 21st.
21st, man.
Congrats on all of that, DB. Thank you for coming on with us today, bro.
Thanks so much, Waz. Always happy to be here.
Appreciate you.
Our kids have said to us since we moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See what makes Minnesota the Star of the North. New residents share why they love calling it home at exploreminnesota.com/live.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See what makes Minnesota the Star of the North. New residents share why they love calling it home at exploreminnesota.com/live.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See what makes Minnesota the Star of the North. New residents share why they love calling it home at exploreminnesota.com/live.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See what makes Minnesota the Star of the North. New residents share why they love calling it home at exploreminnesota.com/live.